From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has welcomed what he called the warm climate of reconciliation and dialogue after his sister and other members of a high-level North Korean delegation returned from opening ceremonies of the Winter Olympics in South Korea. Security analyst Harry Kazianis with the Center for the National Interest said the North Korean leader likely feels emboldened.
All the different pageantry and photo ops that showed his sister and other senior North Korean officials, you know, meeting with the South and being in the VIP booth during the opening games of the Winter Olympics was a clear win for them.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in met four times with Kim's sister, Kim Yo-jong, who handed him what is called a personal letter from her brother proposing an inter-Korean summit. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence signaled more openness in talks with the North without precondition, but Secretary of State Rex Tillerson affirmed Monday in Cairo the first step must be taken by Pyongyang.
As we've said for some time, it's really up to the North Koreans to decide when they're ready to engage with us in a sincere way.
Pence said if the North wants sanctions relief over its nuclear program, it must first take meaningful steps toward denuclearization. South African reports say the leadership of the ruling African National Congress has decided to remove embattled President Jacob Zuma over corruption allegation. The party's leadership met hours on Monday with the 75-year-old Zuma. Meanwhile, the opposition is calling for the dissolution of parliament and new elections. Given a looming change in leadership, Musi Mamani leads the Democratic Alliance.
So that we can contest elections and ultimately give him a fresh mandate to a sixth parliament.
Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa, who was elected ANC party chief, appears set to assume office should Zuma step down. This is VOA News. The White House Monday dismissed as false an Israeli assertion the two countries had discussed Israel's annexation of Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told a closed-door meeting of his Likud party he had been talking to the Americans about it for some time. A later clarification said Israel updated Washington about proposed legislation. Russell Stone, professor emeritus at the American University Center for Israel Studies, said it was an effort to make news where there is no news.
It's clear that settlements have been a topic of discussion between Americans and Israelis and within the Israeli political leadership. The current news apparently resulted from a proposed piece of legislation from some right-wing legislators in Israel that will probably go nowhere.
A spokesman for Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas said no one has the right to discuss the situation of the occupied Palestinian lands. Abu Redena said annexation would destroy all efforts to try to save the peace process. In Moscow Monday, Mr. Abbas himself said Palestinians refused to cooperate with the U.S. as a mediator in the dispute with the Israelis, following the U.S. decision to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Secretary of State Tillerson held talks in Cairo with his Egyptian counterpart, Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry, and said Washington stands with Egypt in its fight against jihadists.
Egypt's been battling this level of extremism for many years, and we continue to be steadfast partners in their response to these attacks throughout this time.
Tillerson also appealed for respect for human rights and civil liberties in Egypt, and called for a free and fair election when it's held in March. Tillerson will hold talks also in Jordan, Kuwait, Lebanon, and Turkey. At least two were killed in clashes Monday between demonstrators and riot police in the West African country of Guinea following local election results. The violence appears to be linked to opposition charges of fraud in the February 4th vote. Last week, dozens were arrested following an arson attack that left five children dead. Ukraine's opposition leader Mikhail Saakashvili was deported to Poland Monday in a long-running political dispute with one-time ally, Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko. The former president of Georgia briefly held a provincial governorship in Ukraine before the two had a falling out and Saakashvili joined the opposition. President Donald Trump Monday unveiled a fiscal 2019 $4.4 trillion budget blueprint that proposes a boost to military spending and cuts in domestic programs. It would boost the deficit by more than $1 trillion. On Wall Street, all three major stock indices rebounded Monday after last week's biggest drop in 2 years. The benchmark Dow Jones rose more than 400 points to close at 24,601 Monday. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
We'll be right back. Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbatha in Washington. Today is Tuesday, February 13th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Sierra Leone's ruling party predicts victory in the March 7th presidential election.
The presidential candidate for the All People's Congress, Dr. Samora Camara, is a seasoned diplomat, somebody that has worked for the IMF, the World Bank, the Commonwealth, and locally, he served as a financial secretary in the Ministry of Finance.
Abdoulaye Bérété, spokesman for Sierra Leone President Ernest Bai Koroma. South Sudan sentences a former rebel spokesman to death. Zimbabwe's president visits Botswana in a bid to strengthen diplomatic and economic ties. And a lawsuit has been filed in the United States for war crimes against a former commander of a notorious Liberian military unit in the 1990s.
We want to make sure that people are held accountable so that such actions can serve as a deterrent for people who want to make war in the future. People must understand that when you make war, if you commit crimes, they have to be held accountable.
Hassan Belite is executive director of the Global Justice and Research Project. The East African Legislative Assembly steps up efforts to promote Swahili as a common language. An immigrant and refugee teenagers adapt to first year at an American high school. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Sierra Leone's opposition parties and civil society groups have expressed concern about Chinese citizens openly campaigning for candidates from the ruling All People's Congress, the APC party, ahead of the March 7th presidential elections. This after the ruling party Monday held its latest political campaign rally in the capital of Freetown. Local media reports cited Asian-looking people wearing T-shirts and paraphernalia of the ruling party and openly campaigning during the Monday's event. The opposition group say it is illegal and an affront to the constitution for non-citizens to participate in the country's democracy. To get a reaction, VOA's Peter Clotty reached presidential spokesman Abdoulaye Bérété in Sierra Leone's capital, Freetown.
The presidential candidate for the All People's Congress, Dr. Samora Camara, is a seasoned diplomat, somebody that has worked for the IMF, the World Bank, the Commonwealth, and locally, he served as a financial secretary in the Ministry of Finance, a ministry that he also served as a finance minister, and later, of course, as governor for the Bank of Sierra Leone. He is an economic expert. But for us, though, our party believes in grassroots. It is governing for the grassroots people in an all-inclusive approach, whereby the middle class and whosoever will be incorporated. But for us, though, we have a history of a development agenda. Our track record is such that for the past 30 years or so, and for over 50 odd years after independence, it is only the APC that has brought electricity from a paltry 10% to over 500%. And the only party that has brought pipeline water to the respective districts in this country. And of course, our governance record is such that we have never executed anybody since 2007, something that is a novelty compared to the history of this country. So based on that, the public continues to repose confidence in the leadership of not only President Koroma, but the agenda for the continuity of our development trajectory, so that everybody in an inclusive group, we will be able to continue to transform this country.
Some opposition candidates have accused the government of the failure to resolve economic challenges the country faces, and that President Ernest Bai Koroma has supervised endemic corruption in the country, and Dr. Samora Camara is integral to this government that he served. So what is the difference? They are demanding change. Your response to that?
Well, people will say they want change. Most of them were hibernating in the diaspora, and it is only when it is time for politics they came back. Imagine one of the flag bearers is almost 50-something odd years old, and he has never voted for anybody in this country. So the people are now asking, why would you want us to vote for you when you've never voted for anybody? And in the fight against graft in this country, I can tell you when President Koroma came into governance, he came in 2007 on a platform to address corruption. That is why today we are even partnering with the Department for International Development, DFID, in the UK, in our fight against corruption. And so far, since the United States established the Millennium Challenge Corporation in 2004, it is only under President Koruma that we are able to meet the indicators in the fight against corruption that we graduated from a threshold to a compact. And later, when we fell by a few decimals, the U.S. government still gave this government $44.4 million to address water and sanitation and electricity on the premise that, indeed, the government is serious and very desirous in the fight against graft. So whatever the opposition says, we'll not dismiss it as a distraction, because we want to acknowledge that, indeed, corruption is a challenge for us as in any other country. But we have come out with the strongest legislation since 2008, whereby we even divorced the political concurrence for cases to be prosecuted.
Abdoulaye Berete is Sierra Leone's presidential spokesman. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital, Freetown. The Center for Justice and Accountability on Monday filed a civil lawsuit in the U.S. state of Pennsylvania against Liberian Moses Thomas, who resides in the state. Mr. Thomas commanded the then elite but notorious special anti-terrorist unit, known as SATU, of the Liberian military in the late 1980s and in early 1990s. The suit alleges that Mr. Thomas directed the unit to attack the St. Peter's Lutheran Church in Monrovia and killing about 600 people during Liberia's civil war. Mr. Thomas told VOA Monday he has been notified by the court about the lawsuit and given 21 days to submit a rebuttal. He says he has no idea what the lawsuit is alleging, but Hassan Beliti, executive director of the Global Justice and Research Project, says some of the witnesses in the knew Mr. Thomas prior to the alleged incident and were able to recognize him during the alleged incident.
Our investigation over several years, about 3 or so years, revealed that Mr. Thomas, then head of the special anti-terrorist unit, commonly known in Liberia, SATU, was present and led some of his troops to the Lutheran Church, where many people were killed. And victims and witnesses point fingers at Mr. Thomas as having led the troops to the Lutheran Church. And you remember, this was one of the worst massacres in the history of the two Liberian civil wars.
So are you alleging that Mr. Thomas personally participated in these alleged killings that you said took place?
Survivors are telling us that Mr. Thomas was present, and troops under his command were also present on the ground. And witnesses are also alleging to us that Mr. Thomas was heard speaking. And this is very important, because under the theory of command responsibility legally, if he was there and his troops committed the crime, question would be, well, was he there in the first place? And why did his troop open fire on unarmed civilians who had been displaced as a result of the war that had begun in 1989, 24th December? So this points a clear finger at some perpetrator. But based on our investigation over a period of years, definitely, we are quite confident that the testimonies of the witnesses and victims quite accurate.
That's what exactly I was going to ask you. This incident we are talking about is probably 28 or 30 years ago. So can you trust the recollection of your so-called survivors or witnesses?
Well, this has to do with lifetime scars that were left on people. Certainly we do. There are other sources of information that point to the involvement of Mr. Moses Thomas in this action. So, yes, we do trust the recollection of all witnesses. Some of the information we have revealed that some of the witnesses knew Mr. Moses Thomas prior to the incident, and they were able to recognize him, recognize his voice, and they were also able to see other people who were with him. There were several groups that went there, but from all indication, Mr. Thomas, what our witnesses are saying, was largely in charge of whatever went on in the church.
You said that this case is a civil case, not criminal. So what exactly do you hope to prove or accomplish?
We hope to prove that perpetrators should be held accountable. We hope to prove that Mr. Temes is responsible, in part, for what happened that night, and that we want to bring some closure to the survivors. If we don't do that, definitely, the laws in the United States may not be able to hold Mr. Temes responsible.
Hassan Belite is Executive Director of the Global Justice and Research Project. He was speaking with me from the Liberian capital, Monrovia. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington today. It's Tuesday, February 13th. Daybreak Africa time is 15 and a half minutes past the hour. A South Sudan High Court judge on Monday sentenced former South Sudan First Vice President Riek Machar's former spokesman to death after he was found guilty of treason. Dimo Silva Aurelio has more for VOA from Juba.
James Gadet Dak was arrested by Kenyan authorities in late 2016 and handed over to South Sudan National Security Service officers after he applauded the firing of a Kenyan general who was commander of UN peacekeepers when a deadly flare-up in violence occurred between government forces and Machar's bodyguards in Juba in July 2016. Presiding Judge Lado Armenio says James Gadet used social media to post information which the court deemed instigative and insulting the presidency. Judge Armenio also said Gadet's posting on social media constituted a conspiracy to overthrow a legitimate government. Reading out his verdict in Arabic, Judge Armenio sentenced Gadet to death by hanging.
The court has ruled the following. One, imprisonment for 1 year starting from 29th December 2016 for violating Article 76 of the Penal Code. And the second is imprisonment for 20 years for violating Article 75 of the Penal Code. The third sentence is hanging to death for violating Article 64 of the South Sudan Penal Code 2008.
Judge Armenio says Gadet has the right to appeal his death sentence.
The accused has the right to appeal within 15 days, starting from today, according to Article 263 of the Criminal Procedures Act 2008.
Gadet appeared in court dressed in a green jersey and slippers, also known as flip-flops. He appeared calm throughout the proceedings and did not show any emotions when the verdict was read. Gadet appeared in court without his defense lawyers, who withdrew from the case more than 3 weeks ago, citing Article 8 of the Cessation of Hostilities Agreement, which requires the parties to release prisoners of war and political detainees. When asked if he would make a plea, Gadet simply said, "I am innocent," and declined to comment further. Monyloak Alor Kuol, who was Gadet's lead defense lawyer until stepping down from the case, declined to comment on today's verdict. But Kuol told South Sudan in Focus that the government should have withdrawn from the case based on Article 8 of the Cessation of Hostilities Agreement signed in December last year.
We didn't see any justification for the process of the trial. And we were insisting that the prosecution, being the legal advisor to the government, because they are part of the Ministry of Justice, and the government is a signatory to the Cessation of Hostilities Agreement, the Minister of Justice should have advised the government and draw its attention to Article 8. And on that basis, they should have withdrawn the case from the court. So that was our line. And we still believe that should have been the case.
Kuol insists that the Cessation of Hostilities Agreement, which the government and opposition parties signed last month, requires the release of all political detainees, including Gadet, who is a member of the SPLM in opposition. Specifically, the ceasefire deal requires all parties to release all persons who have been deprived of their liberty for reasons related to South Sudan's conflict, including prisoners of war, political prisoners, detainees, and abducted women and children. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
Zimbabwe President Emmerson Mnangagwa continues his two-day visit to Botswana today, Tuesday. His first says since taking office, it aims at strengthening diplomatic and economic ties between the two countries. Evan Zinigar of VOA Zimbabwe Service talked to Gary Juma, an economist based in Habaroni, Botswana, about the visit.
I think as a Zimbabwean community, we are so excited about the visit of our president into Botswana, given the acrimony that, as you correctly mentioned, which has been going on between the two countries for a number of years. Botswana has hosted quite a number of Zimbabweans who has actually made Botswana as a second home. And the current strategy to reach out to all the business community, to all the countries that want to invest in Zimbabwe, we feel it's a positive move in the right direction. And we see it bearing fruits in the long term in the form of increased investment, especially from companies from Botswana. We've seen quite a number of companies in Botswana expressing their interest to invest in Zimbabwe. Some of them have already invested in Zimbabwe, for example, Choppies. There are other companies that are also contemplating to invest in the country but have been sitting on the sidelines of late. So the visit by the president, it's a positive step in the right direction in the sense that it will give that assurance to the investors that Zimbabwe is open for business once again.
Do you see Botswana and Zimbabwe engaging at the same level, given that Botswana has a very strong currency in form of the pula, and Zimbabwe is struggling to have its own currency, and as we currently using all sorts of currencies, mainly the US dollar and the South African rand? What does that mean today, re-engaging in business vis-a-vis our monetary values in terms of currencies?
I think what will be more important is for us to ensure that we strike deals that are of mutual benefit to both countries. And as much as we don't have a currency of our own, and it appears that our gross domestic product is relatively smaller as compared to GDP of Botswana, but what is more important is to ensure that we trade relations, bilateral relations that are of mutual benefit to those countries. Obviously, as Botswana, they also need a haven for their investment. But whilst we receive those investments, we should also make sure that we derive maximum benefits from it. And any benefits that we derive will be a two-way, not one-way traffic whereby either Botswana benefits only or Zimbabwe benefits only. It should be mutual benefit for both parties.
So do you see businesses in Botswana rushing or running after the open-door policy that the president is preaching and come and invest in Zimbabwe?
Opportunities in Zimbabwe, there are a lot. And over the years, we are very much aware that the business community in Botswana, they've been keeping an eye on the Zimbabwean economy. But then business people now, they don't only rush because of maybe verbal pronouncements. Obviously, they look at our laws in terms of legislation, if we put in place measures that will ensure that their investments are protected in the country. And also things like consistency in terms of policy. Those are the things that will be closely watched at by investors. It's up to us as a country to ensure that we create a conducive environment that is attractive for business. We speak together with one voice. There is a coherence between our ministers with the same voice so that the world will take us seriously and they will see that indeed we are so serious about opening the country as a safe haven for investment.
Gary Juma is an economist based in Botswana's capital, Habarini. He spoke with reporter Evans Zinega of VOA's Zimbabwe service. The East African Legislative Assembly is stepping up efforts to promote Swahili as a lingua franca in the 6 East African Community member states. The community lawmakers say lack of a common language is considered one of the barriers to trade in the region. Moses Javier Rimana has the story.
Here in Zanzibar is where you can find the headquarters of East African Kiswahili Commission, the commission that was set up in 2015 in order to promote the language in the East African community. The population here speak no any other language other than Kiswahili. It is also regarded to be a language of business mainly in Uganda, Kenya, and Tanzania. Kenneth Simala, the executive secretary of the East African Kiswahili Commission, said that the 2-year-old commission has already set up strategies to promote the language.
You cannot integrate and develop without language. Language is a tool for communication. Kiswahili is moving all over. It's one of the fastest globalizing language in the world and the only African language that is moving very fast across.
Mohamed Hussein is a resident here in Zanzibar. He believes speaking Swahili reflects African culture. He says that Swahili language is very important to them and that from the language, countries can strengthen their relations if all speak one language, Swahili, the language which is spoken by over 100 million people in the Great Lakes region, is yet to be effective in some member states like South Sudan, Burundi, and Rwanda. This is mainly because the new member countries have already one common language in their respective states. Mariam Yahaya is a Tanzanian East African Legislative Assembly member, said that the language is vital for the regional integration.
As you know, in our region, many of the East Africans speak Kiswahili. Not all of them speak English in the interiors. And these are the majority that we want them to benefit for East Africa integration process. That's why we are really, really putting forward Kiswahili as a media of communication, especially in the borders for ease of trade.
Many border communities in East Africa speak the same languages. Good practices have been identified in these communities that could later enhance the regional integration. In 1928, an interterritorial conference took place in Mombasa, and Zanzibar dialect was chosen as a standard Swahili. But critics say that the success of the regional integration is more of political will than a language, and that if the language is made official, it will cost the community a lot of resources to translate the legal documents into Swahili. As majority of citizens from Burundi, Rwanda, and South Sudan can't easily speak the language, the East African leaders believe that the region with one common language can be a catalyst to promote the integration agenda. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Zanzibar.
Journalist and writer Helen Thorpe spent one school year in a classroom with immigrant and refugee students who had come from different cultures and were just learning to speak English. She watched those newcomers overcome challenges and worked hard to succeed in school and beyond. Thorpe shares their stories in a new book. She spoke about it with Faisal El-Mazri, as narrated by Fifth Lapidus.
Sitting in room 142 at South High School in Denver, Colorado, gave Helen Thorpe an opportunity to meet the world. The class included 22 foreign students who came from Mozambique, Burma, Eritrea, El Salvador, Mexico, Iraq, Congo, Bhutan, Tajikistan, and Mauritania.
They had like the ordinary struggles of teenagers everywhere, plus this extra added burden of being in a new country and trying to figure out a new culture and trying to figure out a new language all at the same time. There were 14 different languages represented in the room among the 22 students. Many of the students were the only one in the room who spoke a given language. The majority of the students were very isolated in the classroom and just in general in their new life in America. They weren't able yet to make friends because they were just starting out learning English. And so that loneliness was something that they were all struggling to overcome.
As time went by, they were able to overcome it.
I watched that loneliness dissipate and go away as they figured out that they could use Google Translate to send text messages back and forth from their home languages to another person's home language. What they were all hungry for was to make friends, to learn how to fit in, to feel like they were accepted at their new high school, to feel like they belonged to a community.
In her book, The Newcomers, Finding Refuge, Friendship, and Hope in an American Classroom, Thorpe details some of the challenges many of these students faced. Iraqi sisters Jacqueline and Mariam were struggling with difficult memories.
Jacqueline and Mariam have witnessed car bombings. When their family fled Iraq, they went to Syria, and they survived the Syrian civil war as well as the Iraq war. Their father vanished during that time. Their mother became a single parent, and then she struggled to keep the girls safe. They fled to Turkey, and then she got the chance to resettle here in the United States. So those girls coming here, this was the first opportunity they had to live in a safe home in 10 years' time.
For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
And that's it for this Tuesday, February 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very nice day.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
on the next Straight Talk Africa. We'll speak with Bobby Wine, the outspoken Ugandan member of parliament, is a businessman, activist, humanitarian, and musician. His lyrics often advocate for Uganda's struggling and poor. Bobby Wine joins host Shaka Sali to discuss his role as an artist in African politics.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Thank you.